pharmacy rebate revenue by $59 million in the 14-15 biennium and by $15 million in the 16-17 biennium. We have long been the medical assistance program has long been able to bill pharmacy manufacturers for rebates on our fee for service pharmacy business through a change that was in the Accountable Care Act. We started being able to bill for the same kind of rebates on the managed care pharmacy business that we do, and we only started being able to bill this about a year and a quarter ago, and we have been cautious about forecasting how much we were going to get out of that. So we initially budgeted quite a substantial amount, but we increased it in the November forecast, and we're increasing it again in the February forecast. And the reason for the change in the February forecast is we now have a better model to forecast this with, and part of what is changing it is that we are recognizing that MA adults without children have a pretty high pharmacy cost. And so when we make adjustments in how we're forecasting, recognizing the higher pharmacy costs that we pay for MA adults without children in managed care, we forecast a higher amount of pharmacy rebates coming from the managed care business. But when the federal government starts to pay 100% of the cost for the MA adults without children, the pharmacy rebates are also going to be 100% federal. And so our change in the forecast affects 14 and 15 while we're still getting the payback from a 50% state coverage of the adults without kids and not so much in the 16-17 biennium. A second change that had a significant effect is that in most of the segments of medical assistance, we are recognizing in the February forecast that the capitation rates for calendar year 13 are going to be lower than we had anticipated in the November forecast. And so that we treat that as lowering the base not only for calendar year 13 but also into the future. So if the rates go up 3% less, that means that our forecast of what we're going to spend in managed care for whatever group is affected is now 3% less, and it's also 3% less out into the future, because we still assume whatever change in rates we were assuming before, but the base is lower now. And a similar thing happens with the adults without children. The effect of the HMO rate change on the adults without children in the 14-15 biennium is a reduction of $12 million, and in the 16-17 biennium, it's a reduction of only $1 million. So we have a $10 million difference there. One more large piece is a technical fix, or a fix to a technical error in our forecast. we forecast expenditures month by month going out into the future. And in doing that, we have to take account of the various ways, of the various timing of HMO payments. In our current statute, we always delay the HMO payment for June until the next fiscal year. In the current law, we also delay the May payment until the next fiscal year in the odd-numbered years, which is end of biennium, basically. So we delay May payment in 13 and in May 15, and we don't pay it until July. And then the disabled capitation product is a bit different. There's even more delay, but there's an additional end of biennium delay. We had a mistake in a formula about the timing of these payments, and we had one extra payment in FY15 that should have been in 16, and we were also short a payment in 16. So we had to move one payment that has a state share value in the February forecast of about $20 million that we moved from the 14-15 biennium into the next biennium, and we added a $20 million payment to the 16-17 biennium. Okay. Now, we don't like to make mistakes, but we like to get them fixed timely before they have an effect on the budget or the appropriations for the program. So that's a decrease of $20 million in 14-15 biennium and an increase of $40 million in the 16-17 biennium. And so that accounts for most of the difference between the decrease of $142 million in 14-15 and only $13 million in 16-17.
That's helpful. Thank you. Say one thing. In this committee, we're trying to change our terminology of adults without children to adults without dependent children. And your discussion about the pharmacy rebate really highlights why we're trying to do that. Because when you say adults without children, people tend to think of young people. And if you say adults without dependent children, it starts to make folks understand that we're often talking about people who are, you know, beyond raising their children. And I think that would largely be the population engaged with the pharmacy rebate. So we're trying to change our terminology in here, and I think it could be helpful to just the general public as we do it. So if you know,
I can see the value of that, Mr. Chairman.
It's hard, though.
It may not fit into labels very easily.
Right. Okay. Anyway, thank you for that explanation of the change without the Medicaid expansion.
Okay. There are small changes, so it's mostly an issue of small changes across the board in the MA forecast, other than the technical change. Nursing home forecast is less than 1% lower. The DD waiver forecast is about 1% lower. But as always, there are lots of ups and downs, and the details are in the larger document, but I'm not going to go through details. If you have questions about any of that, either now or sometime in the future, you can refer the questions to the I'm not sure what the proper procedure is, maybe to the chair or the fiscal analyst, and I can provide answers.
Okay.
On the Minnesota Care part, this is where the savings of the expansion show up in the forecast. So the healthcare access fund total change is an increase of $17 million in the 12-13 biennium. It's a decrease of $196 million in 14 and 15, and a decrease of of $390 million in 16 and 17. If we take out the effects of the expansion bill, then we get still the $17 million increase, but a decrease in 14-15 of only $4 million and a decrease of $70 million in 16 and 17. The relatively larger change in 16 and 17 comes mostly from a lower enrollment forecast for the adults without dependent children in the Minnesota Care Program. Now, on the back of this sheet, I provided a summary of the enrollment changes, which were included in the February forecast because of the expansion bill. And so you can see here the expected numbers added to MA enrollment. We generally show numbers like this in terms of average enrollment, and the effect in fiscal year 14 is a six-month effect averaged over 12 months. And so it looks so small, it's really like the 12,002 is actually a forecast that for the second 6 months of the year we'll have average enrollment of 24,000.
Right.
But for computational reasons, we always divide by 12 months instead of by a lesser number. So we get, in total, we get additional enrollment in the medical assistance program in the neighborhood of 60,000 after the phase-in is complete. The effect on the Minnesota Care Program looks very small for the parents and the 19 and 20-year-olds. And the reason for that is our experience with these two groups is very different. We are assuming as represented in these numbers that all of the adults without dependent children are going to move to the medical assistance program. But because the expansion bill left open the possibility for people to stay in Minnesota Care if they chose, we assumed that only 10% of the parents and 19 and 20-year-olds would move from Minnesota Care to the medical assistance program. If we get subsequent law change that says if you have MA eligibility, you don't get Minnesota Care, then we will recognize the shift of the remaining 90% of the parents and the 19 or 20-year-olds who fall into the affected income bracket.
Great.
So I will stop there, Mr. Chairman, and answer any questions.
Questions from the committee. They must have tracked everything you said, George. That's impressive. All right. With Senator Sharon.
Just see if I can articulate this. You calculated 10% expected Minnesota Care enrollment in the income bracket. There are more that could move who are dual eligible either for Minnesota Care or Medicaid. And we could pass law, you're saying, that would say if you're eligible for Medicaid, that's where you go, right?
Yes.
And if we do that, are you able to say what that might look like financially for us?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, if the expansion bill said if you're MA eligible, that's what you get, and you don't get Minnesota Care, we would have showed you the same numbers, except that instead of assuming 10% of the Minnesota Care group is going to move to medical assistance, we would have assumed that 100% would move. But the other number would not be changed. The number that we're allowing for additional people to come into the medical assistance program would not be any different. So it's a bit artificial in a way, but we didn't want to say that if when we expanded eligibility for MA children in the early 2000s, we found that we got a big expansion of eligibility in medical assistance, but a relatively small effect on the children who were in the Minnesota Care program. A very high proportion of the kids in the Minnesota Care program stayed there. And so when we look now at expanding eligibility for the parents and the 19 and 20-year-olds, if that option is open to people, we're assuming that a large percentage of them would choose to stay in the Minnesota Care program. But the other numbers, bringing more people into medical assistance, those are not affected. Does that?
You know, a follow-up I have, that was largely about the population shifts. I'm wondering about the money.
If we subsequently forecast that the 90% is moved into MA, what we are currently doing is assuming that when we move a group from Minnesota Care into medical assistance, that the money that goes with them will be the same as the forecasted expenditure for those people if in the Minnesota Care program. Now, that's of some importance because the medical assistance capitation rates tend to be higher than the Minnesota Care capitation rates for somebody similarly situated. But we're assuming that if we move a whole group from Minnesota Care into medical assistance, that they will carry the lower cost with them that we're expecting them to have in the Minnesota Care program.
So essentially, on the fiscal side of the books, you wouldn't change your money forecast based on this population shift. It would change the way this enrollment effect looks, but not necessarily track in the financial, the other side of the sheet. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, it would move their cost from the health care access
over
fund
to the
to
general
fund.
Yes.
But we would assume that it's very close to equal.
Okay. I that helps me. Senator Sharon, did you have a follow-up as well?
I guess I was thinking, thank you, Senator, that the Medicaid expansion, if we move people from Minnesota Care over within the poverty levels, that there would be a more federal dollars paying that would create further cost savings in the general fund in the Minnesota Care, because we aren't spending Minnesota Care dollars. I assume
Mr. Hoffman?
That.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, we are currently getting 50% federal matching on these people in the Minnesota Care program.
I think so.
And that's the reason that it would be the same state cost, because we're already
not new,
getting.
It's not new
federal funding.
Right.
That's correct.
Not new.
And what we lose is they wouldn't be paying premiums anymore. So there would be a small cost for the loss of the premium revenue. the state share of the premium revenue.
Would there be administrative cost savings from having a higher percentage of Medicaid enrollees? I mean, are we able to count the Minnesota Care enrollees in our penetration rate? I don't know.
We have a whole complex set of issues about the future of Minnesota Care.
And yes, we do.
So I think I can say that all other things being equal, if we move 12,000 people out of the Minnesota Care program, we'd have somewhat less administrative cost in the department, but all other things don't show much prospect of being equal. So,
right. Okay. Well, I think that gives us a framework to understand the numbers you've presented quite well, and help foster our discussion. Any other question from members? All right. Seeing none, we'll call up Assistant Commissioner Leitz and begin our overview of the health care delivery and payment reforms in Minnesota. I know there's been a lot of attention paid to this. I'm very anxious to hear this presentation. It's kind of the work that was authorized in previous legislatures to allow DHS to go build these. I know it was instrumental in our being granted a state innovation grant from the feds, and you know, this is the type of work that's going to move us forward in the triple aims of healthcare: providing better experiences for patients interacting with the system, better population-based health, and in the end, bending the cost curve and giving us much better results overall. And it's been really exciting to watch it develop. And it's a collaborative effort. This is entirely voluntary, and we've had a tremendous response from our provider community stepping forward and building the models that are really helping us move forward toward these really important goals. I know we spend a great deal of time right now talking about nuts and bolts of insurance reform and things like that, but this true health care reform is on the horizon, and really looking forward to hearing of the tremendous progress made. So with that, Assistant Commissioner Leitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at DHS. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to come talk about the efforts that the department is collaboratively working with the providers in Minnesota on reforming some of the ways that we pay for and deliver health care. I'm going to just start with a little bit of context about what some of the reasons were we've been moving in this direction with the state's Medicaid program. And then I'll get into some of the specifics of a couple of models that we've been working with. Just to remind folks, our healthcare programs really encompass two major programs: the medical assistance program, which enrolls about a little over 750,000 people on an annual basis, and the Minnesota Care program, which is our state subsidized program for people who have income that is above the Medicaid eligibility levels, and close to 130,000 people are enrolled in that program. We also supplement the Medicare program for low-income seniors who are enrolled in Medicare. They're eligible to also be enrolled in Medicaid, which helps them with some of their cost sharing and other things associated with the Medicare program. Our efforts so far that I'll talk about really focused on the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs, but I'll touch at the end about how what we're thinking about with that last group, which is called the dually eligible population. You know, as the legislature, I think over the course of the past several years has recognized, there is a fair amount of transformation in our delivery system that's necessary. State budget pressures over the course of the last decade, frankly, have put pressures on the Medicaid program in particular, but other payers of health care as well have been facing those same pressures as the economy has been slower. Part of the reason that we've seen pressure on the health care side, health care cost growth side, is that provider financial incentives that we have put in place in front of them don't encourage reducing costs or improving quality. That's not a provider failing. That's the incentive in the system right now. We pay largely still on a fee-for-service basis. And because we do that, there's not an incentive necessarily to rein in costs or quality. And what that's done is really limit provider innovation. It's often penalized rather than supported in our system. If you think about efforts that a hospital, for example, might undertake to reduce hospitalizations, rehospitalizations for things, they'd like to do that because they recognize that rehospitalizations are bad for patient outcomes. In the system that we have today, if they're able to actually do things upstream, work with that patient, coordinate the care better for that patient to reduce rehospitalization, they actually are penalized because that rehospitalization would have paid them. And the efforts that they take to avoid the rehospitalization doesn't. And so the incentives that we've placed in front of providers really have led to kind of a messy system that way. And so some of the efforts that we're undertaking are attempting to sort of overcome that. We also know that the health outcomes for Medicaid enrollees need to be improved, and that care should be centered around patients and their families. If you think about a typical Medicaid enrollee, for example, who might be disabled, they obviously have health care needs, but they oftentimes have social service needs and other types of needs that need to be coordinated. So our current methods for paying providers misalign the incentives for them, and they lack incentives for care coordination and integration of care throughout the system. Again, they penalize investments in prevention because prevention actually prevents things that we would have otherwise paid for down the road, and they don't necessarily emphasize patient involvement. So what our efforts are looking at right now, and these are efforts that are ongoing throughout, I think, the marketplace right now, is really addressing the challenges that are there by and looking at the changes that are going to be necessary in provider payment and methods of delivery care to overcome some of these barriers that we have. We recognize that key roles need to be played by everybody. Consumers need to be involved. Employers need to be involved. Providers, the health plans, government payers such as Medicaid, and others really all need to collectively be working together to affect the transformations that are necessary. And ultimately, what we're after here is giving providers the freedom and support that's necessary to foster the innovation within their delivery system so that they can determine the most effective and efficient means of providing and improving health to the folks that they serve. So as we've thought about developing what I'll describe in a second here, I think the approach that the legislature asked us to take and that we've taken is really to define what we seek: better coordination of care, accountability for costs, but under a framework of flexibility for providers, rather than being top-down and specific about the how, what we want, rather than the how we expect you to get there. This has been work that we've developed very much in partnership with providers to develop the process. We wanted to give providers a choice to participate, meaning it wasn't mandatory. With the models I'll describe are voluntary models that providers have stepped up and said, we want to be a part of this transformation. We wanted to provide multiple opportunities for innovation, meaning that we didn't want to have a one-size-fits-all model, but rather multiple models that providers could choose what fit best for them, and to allow for local flexibility and innovation under a common framework of accountability. We recognize that what works in Minneapolis isn't necessarily going to work in rural Minnesota. What works in St. Cloud isn't necessarily going to work in Duluth. And so we wanted to have a variety of models available that met local needs. We wanted models. I talked about sort of having flexibility under a framework of accountability. And what the framework of accountability that we have been working with providers on is the following. It's models that are based on and have accountability for total cost of care. So that as a provider looks at what they're held accountable for, it's actually this overall cost of care rather than individual service cost of care. We wanted models that would drive rapidly away from the incentive to do more, getting away from that fee-for-service mentality, but models that drive towards increasing levels of integration, meaning we know that people frequently need services not just on the healthcare side, but in other parts of the healthcare system, whether it be public health or social services. We wanted that integration to occur. And the legislature in 2008 passed a law that required, that brought into the state the statewide quality measurement system, which measures providers' quality of care based on work that had previously been done by Minnesota Community Measurement, brought it sort of statewide so that providers weren't being measured multiple different ways by multiple different plans for quality of care, but rather a single standard way of doing that. And so common quality measurement is also built into this. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn to a couple of examples of what we're doing to help to foster some of this innovation. Again, very much in collaboration with the providers. The first one I'll describe is our healthcare delivery systems demo, and then I'll touch briefly on Hennepin Health. I know you have presenters here from Hennepin Health, so I'll only very briefly talk about our collaboration with Hennepin County on this. The first example that I have is the healthcare delivery systems demonstration. This was authorized by the 2010 legislature. The legislature asked the department to develop and authorize a demonstration project to test alternative ways for delivering health care. But the overall goal here was to work with provider organizations to have them provide services to a specified patient population for an agreed-upon total cost of care, so that we had sort of this total cost of care aggregate goal that we were working with. We, in implementing this legislation, went through a process, and I wanted to spend just a couple seconds on the timeline here because I think it's important to understand kind of the approach that we've taken. The first thing that we did was develop what we called an RFI, or a request for information. Before even going out with this request for proposals for people to participate, we took a step back and we set out a number of questions that we wanted people to weigh in on around how we should best develop this this HCDS, as we call it, the healthcare delivery system demo. And we put out a request for information, and we received an overwhelming number of responses. We didn't know how many people would actually respond to it, and we were surprised by the range of responses that we received from provider organizations, from health plans, from local government, from social service organizations, all of whom wanted to give us input on how this should be developed. And I think that demonstrated that these models really do to extend beyond just the delivery system, that people are thinking about this much more broadly, which is the way they should be thinking about it. Based on that input, we developed and issued a request for proposals for people to participate in this demonstration in the summer of 2011. We received some good feedback on that initial RFP that we put out, and we modified the RFP based on feedback that we received, and ultimately had our RFP responses due near the end of 2011. The responses that we received were, I think, we were pleased to see that the responses were broadly representative of geographic areas of the state as well as organizational structures, and I'll touch on that in just a moment. We ended up signing contracts with six providers who will serve nearly 100,000 of our Medicaid enrollees. And those provider organizations started in our HCDS model in January of this year. And the demonstration period is a three-year period, starting in calendar year 13 and running through calendar year 15. The six organizations who are participating are listed here. What I'll note on this is just the wide range and diversity of the groups who are participating. You have CentraCare and Essentia Health, who are outside of the Twin Cities metro area, serving largely rural or non-metro populations. Children's, which I think you'll be hearing from in a few minutes, serving a pediatric population. The federally qualified health center urban health network, which is a really unique collaborative, you'll be hearing from them as well, of 10 federally qualified health centers who formed a separate entity to jointly come in and work with us on this project. A partnership between Allina Health and Health Partners, and then North Memorial. So you have a wide range of providers participating, which
and Essentia.
And Essentia Health as well, which I mentioned along with Essentia Care, obviously as part of serving a non-metro population. So we're very gratified by that. By the way, Mr. Chair, I might add our largest
participant.
Yes,
I noticed that.
Yes. Yep. I'll touch on a few of the key design elements here, just so you have some base understanding of what we're working with. I've listed them out, but I'll touch on what the payment model agreements look like, the methodology that we use to assign patients to those providers, how our quality measures are done, what the data feedback is, and then the way that we're working with the MCOs, the managed care organizations, as a part of this. Well, let me first start with what some of the requirements are for provider participation. The six providers future providers have to deliver the full scope of primary care services. We're asking them to coordinate if they don't have these people as part of their networks, coordinate with specialty providers and hospitals. Because this is about integration and really about ensuring that this isn't just about the healthcare system, but also about ensuring that we're coordinating patients' needs across the various systems, we've asked them to demonstrate how they will partner with community organizations and social services to integrate services into their care delivery. And then they have flexibility, though, in the governance structure and care models to encourage innovation and local solutions. We wanted them to have a few key things that we wanted them to work with us on, but then to also have flexibility in terms of how they chose to govern this and what the models were that they used. That's at a provider level. That's their sort of area. The way this works is that providers contract with DHS for both managed care and fee-for-service enrollees under one of two models, either the virtual HCDS or the integrated HCDS. I'll touch on what those are in a second. Both of those models include the same framework, but they have slightly different financial arrangements. Our goal in providing two options, both the virtual and the integrated, was to ensure that this wasn't only focused on very large providers, but that smaller providers who wished to move in this direction could also participate. And I'll describe how that works in a second. And as I mentioned, the agreements are one-year contracts that renew annually for a three-year demonstration project time period. We did it this way since we recognize that we're new at this. The providers are sort of getting their feet wet with us on this. We likely will need to sort of revisit the contract terms each year. We had some initial contracts. They'll be in place for this initial year, but we'll be recontracting each year over this three-year demonstration. So the two models. Model one is the virtual HCDS. And we built this one really for primary care providers who aren't part of integrated delivery systems. They may not be part of a clinic and hospital system, for example. They may just be standalone or freestanding or smaller primary care providers. And what this allows those organizations to do is to participate in a shared savings arrangement with the state. They don't have downside risk. They only have the ability to share savings if the total cost of care of the patients they serve is below what we project it should be. And then model two is the integrated HCDS. And this is really for integrated provider delivery systems that have both inpatient and ambulatory care. You can think of your large systems such as Essentia, such as the Allina or Fairview or Children's. This begins with shared savings in year one. But it phases in what we call downside risk in a two-way risk sharing of both savings and losses by year three. So I'll describe the model more graphically in a moment. But again, what this does is have a shared savings initially with phased in shared savings and shared risk over time. And the HCDSs have the flexibility to propose the amount of risk that they wish to assume. There's also accountability, as I've mentioned, a key piece of this is accountability for total cost of care. Under the payment model agreement that we've reached with these organizations, the HCDS is accountable for its attributed Medicaid enrollees' total cost of care. And we defined total cost of care as a subset of Medicaid services that health care organizations can be reasonably expected to have an impact on. They can elect to add additional services as they wish, but generally these included services include inpatient costs, outpatient costs, costs associated with physician services, certain mental health and chemical health services, and then generally we excluded dental, things like supplies, and long-term care services. The way that we determine what they're accountable for in terms of those are the services they're accountable for, but what patients are they accountable for? We use what's called a patient attribution methodology to do this. And a patient attribution is the typical way that this is done in the marketplace today, and we're following very similar to what the commercial market is doing here. And basically, a patient is attributed based on where they had the most visits using healthcare claims data. We use healthcare claims data to attribute a patient based on where they had the most visits. The goal in attribution is to be reflective of established patient-provider relationships. What we're trying to capture here is to allow for freedom of choice by patients, but also capture when they've established very good patient-provider relationships. So we base attribution on if that person is enrolled in a healthcare home associated with the provider or has a strong primary care relationship with that provider, that patient is attributed to that provider. Patients under this model then still maintain freedom of choice, so they can go to see who they wish to. It's not an opt-in or opt-out. They can go to who they wish. We simply attribute the patient based on the majority of the visits. And then the HCDS receives a monthly attribution roster of people for whom they are accountable, so they know what their patient base is, who they should be working with. One of the other characteristics of the model is shared savings. And what a shared savings or a risk is, are the differences between what was actually spent for the attributed patients and what the projected total cost of care target was for these populations. That's adjusted for patient risk. So what we did in negotiations with the various participating provider organizations is we worked with them around what a reasonable projected total cost of care growth was. And we look at that each year. And then what we do is we measure the actual spending that occurs. And if the provider organization comes in below what the target was, we actually cut them a check at the end of the year for the shared savings. We've saved money relative to what we expected to spend, and they get to participate in some of those savings. Existing provider payment does persist during the demonstration, and then the annual shared savings or losses is really a settle-up period at the end. All of this is contingent on quality performance. So what we didn't want to create is a situation where we were having lower costs but not getting good quality. We're measuring quality throughout this. They have to meet quality targets, quality of care targets, to be eligible for the gain shares that they would receive. As I mentioned, the quality measures are built off of a subset of that statewide quality measurement system that we put in place starting in after the 2008 legislation. And what that meant is there's no new provider reporting burden here. We really built it off existing systems. And those performance measures ultimately impact the amount of shared savings an HCDS can receive. The final two elements I'll mention relate to data feedback. One of the things that we heard from provider organizations very clearly during the RFI and RFP process was we're interested in participating with you on this kind of shared savings type of a model, but what we need to know is really good detailed information about our patients. And I have to say that's something that the Medicaid program over time hasn't done particularly well. And so we've invested very heavily putting together robust data feedback systems to the providers so that we, on a monthly basis, are able to feed back to them patient-level data that helps identify patient risk and need and facilitates the care management that those patients need in order for them to get better health outcomes. An example is the report highlights recipients with recent visits to the ED or the hospital. This includes readmission counts and information about the probability of future hospitalizations of those patients. We combine up all the data, regardless of whether they're in an HMO or fee-for-service, and so they're getting a complete picture from the Medicaid perspective of those patients. They also receive quarterly reports on their total cost of care performance. So on a monthly basis, we're feeding them back information related to their patients and where they're receiving care. Quarterly, we send them information as to how they're doing on a cost basis. Managed care organizations are a part of this. We enrollees come in either through fee-for-service or through managed care, and MCOs participate with DHS in this HCDS. The state does all the total cost of care calculations and the contracting with providers. And what we do then is work with the MCOs to let them know which patients who are enrolled through them are attributed to which providers. They get the same data on patients in their HCDS. And at the end of the year, when we calculate our shared savings or shared losses, we send back to the MCOs their allocated portion of those shared savings or losses. A goal that we had here and that we really have been striving towards was not to supplant the payment arrangements that MCOs have with providers. There's a lot of innovation occurring there, but rather to supplement that. And so MCOs can still have alternative payment arrangements with providers, even if those providers are participating in our demonstration. So graphically, if you're a virtual HCDS, And this is what the federally qualified health centers are a part of. The blue line would be sort of the projected total cost of care for that population, for the population attributed to a virtual HCDS. So you have sort of the baseline amount of spending and then some agreed upon growth rate. And what the graphic shows is that if the green line comes in below the blue line, which is so the green, blue line being our projected expected expenditures for Medicaid for the population attributed to that virtual HCDS, the green line being the actual spending, that organization, we would essentially look at the difference between the blue and the green lines and split the difference and pay a gain share to that organization if they're able to meet total cost of care. In the integrated model, it's a little bit different. You still have the blue line with the projection of total cost of care and the green line, which represents a shared savings opportunity for that provider. But if the provider organization actually spends more than what the projection was, actually the patients that they deliver care to cost more than what the projected cost was, there's a shared risk as well starting in year two, and that's represented by the red line. We phase that in year two, and by year three, it's symmetric with the green line so that there's both an upside risk and a downside risk for those provider organizations. The second example of something we've been working on is Hennepin Health. And I'll just, as I mentioned, very briefly touch on this since I know you'll have more detailed presentation from Hennepin. This is a collaborative project between the Department of Human Services and Hennepin County. It's really a Medicaid safety net ACO is one way to describe it, focused on our below 75% of poverty Medicaid population. This is the early expansion group. Governor Dayton signed early expansion early in 2011, was really focused on folks with very, very low incomes. This is the former General Assistance Medical Care population, people who have a great deal of complex health needs as well as coexisting mental health and chemical dependency, substance abuse issues. So they're a very complex population. And what this model is working towards doing is really build off some of the experiences that they had in working with the GAMC or CCDS population to integrate medical health, behavior, and social services for single adults who we've sort of worked with the county around identifying those folks who are high users of county services. There's a strong goal here of both reducing the costs of to the healthcare system for these folks who frequently show up in the ED, but on the other side, if we're better able to manage their behavioral health issues, there's potentially savings both for the state on the healthcare side, but for the county on some of the county services side, if that care can be better managed across the spectrum. What we do in the model listed in bullet point three is really work with the county to pay the county a capitation rate, which is roughly equivalent to what we would have otherwise paid for managed care organizations operating with those patients. So instead of us paying directly to a managed care organization, we pay it to the county, and the county manages is able to then move money around within their county system to produce hopefully savings both for our Medicaid program, but savings outside of the Medicaid program maybe at a more county-specific level. The model that we've been working with, and I think it's one that other counties are taking a look at because it really makes a great deal of intuitive sense, includes the integration of medical care with behavioral health, with social services, as well as other county services that might be unique to Hennepin or if another county were to take this on, unique to that county. Again, focusing in on high-need populations who are frequent users of county services. Again, this is trying to get to the notion of aligned incentives, where the county operates a county-run safety net hospital and clinics. It operates a health maintenance organization, has some FQHCs, behavioral health, and other traditional county services. The goal here is to better enable money to be able to be moved to those areas where we can maybe upstream have some interventions that help reduce long-term hospitalizations. Mr. Chair, I'll close with just a couple of comments around where we're headed into the future. Again, we're very excited to have six organizations participating in our initial HCDS. It's 100,000 of our enrollees. We were the first state in the country to receive approval for our model from the federal government to operate. I think they're very excited to have us testing this demonstration. But we think and we're very excited with the work that we're doing with Hennepin. I think there's just a ton of learnings and really great opportunities there. But we really want to continue and to move forward even more rapidly with the care delivery innovation. The federal government last fall provided an opportunity to states to receive a grant or funding through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Innovation Center. And they called this the State Innovation Model or SIM model. The grant was really to provide states with support to develop and test state-based models of multi-payer payment and healthcare delivery systems transformation. Now, we were well positioned to apply for this grant because the legislature, in its wisdom, had given us the authority several years earlier to really move forward with models like this. And I think what you'll see is that that really gave us a leg up in terms of our competitiveness in applying for this grant. The projects are intended to be based and focused on people enrolled in the Medicare program, Medicaid program, or the Children's Health Insurance program. We did apply for this grant in September, had an extremely short application period, and through a lot of extremely hard work with the stakeholders who were absolutely fantastic during this process, of all stripes, the health plans, the providers, community organizations, and a lot of staff work. We did apply for a grant. We were one of six states we received. We were notified just last month that we were one of six states to receive a testing grant. What that will bring is $45 million to Minnesota for us to implement broader payment reform and care delivery reform initiatives over the next 3 years. Minnesota, Massachusetts, Maine, Vermont, Oregon, and Arkansas were the six states to receive those grants. There were 20 other states who received smaller amounts, $2 million or less for more planning. But I think there was a strong view in Minnesota from every stakeholder group that we were through the planning stage. We were really at the testing and implementation stage, and let's move forward and move forward rapidly. Under our model that was approved by the federal government and funded, it's really focused on continuing the transformations that I've talked about, of moving towards taking the HCDS model that we're testing with six providers and bringing it more broadly throughout the state, moving towards a greater integration of care among providers in the community with a real focus on population health. And we called this the Minnesota Accountable Health Model. And that was a recognition that this isn't just about improving health care. Ultimately, in the end, what we want is accountable health, that we're getting good health outcomes for the money that we're spending. And so while we'll know some of that is focused on changing the way care is delivered, some of that is also needs to be focused on making sure that we're making proper investments upstream in public health and in social services and other areas. So under the model, we will be expanding the HCDS and total cost of care payment models opportunities for providers to participate more widespread. We want the models to focus on care that integrates behavioral health, long-term care, and social services. Much of the investment of the $45 million that we've received under this grant is infrastructure investment for providers. If we're asking them to be a part of total cost of care models, they need to have the information systems and data to be able to know and manage their populations well. Some of them are very advanced in this, and other providers would like to be more advanced but don't have the infrastructure or capacity to do that. So we'll be investing in them to be able to allow them to do that. And then we want to move towards greater community involvement and integration. Healthcare is delivered and health is delivered at a very local level. And we want communities to really be able to have the opportunity to come together to get better health overall for their populations, not just better health care. And so there will be a real focus on testing some what we call accountable health communities under this grant opportunity. So our next steps are both SIM under the SIM opportunity as well as more broadly under HCDS. Our application that was funded will build on the healthcare delivery system demonstration projects. We'll be taking that much more broadly. We did issue a new RFP for participation in our HCDS model in January. Our RFP responses will be due this spring. We're hoping to hear from additional providers. We've had some interest already in that, and I think we're very hopeful that there'll be additional providers who are interested. But One of the main points I want to leave you with is that as we build these models forward, we really started with integrating, looking at how we can do a better job with our populations in the healthcare setting. But what we really want to build long-term is a much stronger emphasis on integration of acute care with other types of care, whether that be long-term care, the social service sector, or the public health sphere. And so our models that we'll be putting out will really be trying to build on that. And obviously, we'll be working very closely to with Hennepin Health on their demonstration. We're very excited about the prospects of that and the opportunities that that might bring to get better patient outcomes as well as lower healthcare costs, both at a state level as well as at a local community level. So with that, Mr. Chair, I hope that that was a useful overview of the efforts that are ongoing right now, and certainly be happy to answer any questions.
I think it was a useful overview. A couple of things I know. I think that when I flipped through the innovation model awards, I think Minnesota got the largest award of any of those states. Is that
we did,
correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
So that's what I thought.
You always
I
have to be best in Minnesota, Mr. Chair.
Go deeply into that. I know there's a couple of other questions as well, but I'm wondering on the next steps, when are we going to actually see these charts to determine the savings or you know, the risk? Who gets the savings, the HMO, the state, or the providers? And when do we actually get the first set of results off of these early projects? Do you have an estimate of that?
Mr. Chair, a couple things on that. I think I know that in the Hennepin Health model, for example, started in January of 2012. And so it's still in its early stages as well, although I think there are some initial results that maybe Hennepin might be able to talk a little bit about in their presentation, give you some information. I think that the early findings are very positive on that, both at a county and state level. With regards to the HCDSs, we're just getting those up and running, obviously started in January. We will our first measurement period will be the year of calendar year 2013. And so what we'll be working with the providers on is calculating total cost of care, feeding that information back to them on a quarterly basis. We'll have some information as we start to do that, meaning as the quarterly data feeds go back to the providers. We will obviously at the end of the year then take a look to see whether provider organizations have met their total cost of care targets and then do the calculations at that point. That'll occur in early 2014. So over the course of the year, we'll be getting information. We'll be happy to let you and other committee members know what we're learning as we do that. But we do have to let a little bit of time for that process to work out since that we're just getting those started.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I do, Commissioner. And it's exciting to see where you're at. Really appreciate that. I know this took a lot more work than what you can see. Sometimes innovation does that. Question I have for you is on one of your slides, you talked about generally excluding dental. Could you just tell a bit more about that effect? Because one of the things I noticed in reading ahead here on Hennepin County was the number of ED visits on that were attributed to dental pain. So could you just address that a little more?
Assistant Commissioner Lights.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer. Obviously, dental services are a key part of the health of an individual. And what my slide there was describing was what a provider organization has accountability for. So most of the clinics or the providers who are participating now don't have an associated dental portion of their business. And so we wanted to hold providers accountable for the things that they could reasonably have control over.
Right.
It will be, though, in that provider's interest to work, those participating providers' interest, to actually work with the dental community to make sure a person's dental health is taken care of, because that obviously, ultimately, if it's not, that shows up in poor health overall for people. So while we're not holding them directly accountable for the costs of the dental care, it's excluded services for that piece because they don't really have direct control over it. It probably will be in their interest to work very, very closely with the dental community to make sure those persons' oral health needs are met.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
And in reading ahead, that is exactly what was done, and that's what I think really makes a difference here. They have an incentive to do that, and that's exactly. But it was interesting to see, even in your very first early results, that was already happening, but I just was curious because it was the word generally. And this $45 million that you get, is this, it looks like some of your analytics, some of these other areas, the infrastructure, especially to help the virtual. Is that the case?
Assistant Commissioner Light.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, that's very much the case. It's very much focused on smaller providers, rural providers, long-term care providers, those who aren't, may not necessarily have the financial wherewithal to be able to have some of that capacity.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a little bit more on what Senator Kiffmeyer brought up on the infrastructure investment in IT. Could you expand a little bit on that, how that is being handled? Are we talking about infrastructure investment in this, in all of the providers, in each one, and how, who controls the output and the nature of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, what we're really talking about there is provider systems. Part of the goal here is to get better coordination of care for people as they seek care, whether within a given system or as they transition from maybe an acute care setting to a long-term care setting for a period of time. And what we know is that so the overlay of that is that, you know, there's some accountability now in these models for total cost of care, and so there's a real strong desire for providers to be able to work with patients to manage to help them coordinate their care as they move across those different care settings. The investment that we would be making under the model that we were funded for would really allow some of the provider organizations who currently don't have the financial capacity to make investments in systems that allow them to know who their patients are, where their patients are seeking care, and the types of care that they're seeking. So most of the hospitals, for example, have the ability to do that now. But a lot of the smaller providers in rural areas of the state simply don't have a large enough bottom line to be able to do that. And so the investment here would be to give them some capacity to be able to work with their patients to understand that information and have a better system to be able to capture that than they currently do. The providers would be doing this in collaboration with the patients, and so we're simply providing the opportunity for that infrastructure investment, but it will really be a provider investment that's being made.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Leitz, does that mean that it would be created for vertical, meaning as a person transitions through life, or is there some aspect of horizontal where a person would go from one provider to another provider? Would there be sharing of data?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, it really is intended to ensure that as people do have transitions of care, for example, we know one of the things that occurs very frequently is that as people transition from being in a hospital into a long-term care facility, if the proper information isn't given between the two organizations, whether that be about medications or other things, it frequently results in rehospitalizations for those individuals. What this would be is ability for the hospitals and other providers to hand off information that's pertinent to the care delivery of to that individual to ensure that there's more safety and better outcomes for that patient as that occurs. So it's really about that about transitions such as that.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Leitz, so that means that on occasion there may be the ability to share from one provider to another provider.
Commissioner Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, that is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Is it also, I would think that if I was one of these virtual projects, that besides transitioning information between providers, I would be interested. I thought I heard you talking earlier at looking at the behavior of, you know, even if it's in a general sense of the risk pool that I'm dealing with, so that I can pick up where my costs are and how my risk is increasing because I haven't designed a system to manage a certain thing, like dental, like that I'd pick up that people are going to ER for dental care. Is this IT infrastructure that's being developed will allow these virtual systems to have that kind of analytical capacity so that they can address the issues and create costs, lowering their risk and create cost savings? Is that part of what this project is about.
Commissioner Lights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you've identified it very accurately. That's very much the case. We know there are opportunities to manage the care of patients in a better, more comprehensive manner, and the infrastructure investment we'll be making under the SIM grant, as well as the information that we're feeding back to the HCDSs today, gives them the information they need to be able to know how to best work with patients to make sure that they're getting care at appropriate places for the appropriate services. That's very well stated.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lights. Back to the virtual and the integrated plans. You talked about the gain share between the virtual and the integrated. Is that a negotiated amount that you sit down, and is there a larger percentage for the integrated versus the virtual because of the sheer fact of having some skin in the game for the integrated?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, it is negotiated between the department and the provider organizations. And actually, the provider organizations have the ability to choose the amount of risk that they want to take. And the way that we've worked that is that the larger the amount of gain that they're willing to sort of take on with us, the larger amount that they can potentially get. We've done it for the integrated systems. They can take a smaller amount of risk if they choose to do that, but that means that the gain share is also smaller. So it's kind of, if you will, kind of bilateral that way. So if you take a larger amount of potential risk and gain, you also just have to accept that amount on the risk side as well. But it's something that that's, again, an opportunity for providers to really tailor it to what their needs are and what their local situations are, and for us to kind of work with them on that. But it is negotiated.
But I had a similar question. On the virtual ones, it wasn't that negotiated amount. It looked like when you went through that chart, it was, assuming an improvement and a splitting of the gains.
Let me just be real clear, Mr. Chair. For the virtuals, there's only a gain portion to that. There's no downside or shared risk portion to that. And that's being done on a 50-50 basis with those providers.
Senator Rosen, a follow-up?
Different question.
Okay. Another question. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lights, I'm not sure, perhaps I was reading something else, but is there going to be another additional funding on top of the $45 million that you're going to need? Because obviously this is hands-on with the virtual and integrated plans. And also, is there going to be some accountability measure coming down from the feds, the CMS, as far as what states are working, how's it working? Do you have to report back? I mean, tell me more about their requirements.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we don't anticipate, coming forward with a budget request, for example, to do this hands-on work. We're really grateful for the funding we receive, because you're absolutely right. This is very hands-on work and has required a ton of staff time, both at the DHS and moving forward with the MDH as well. So it's hard work, but it's important work. With regards to our work with the federal government, I think it's fair to say that they're, in the same way that we're kind of working collaboratively with providers, because we're both kind of learning as we go on these models, I think the feds are in a situation where they feel like they're similarly situated. They want states to try new models. They want states to have flexibility in trying those models. I think the relationship has been actually quite productive to this point. Obviously, they want savings. They want to see lower healthcare costs and better patient outcomes. I think we all want that. And so we haven't, we had to include our estimates of how much we thought we might save system-wide from our expansion on this in our application. And they'll be working with us to see whether we how well we do relative to that. But I think we view it as a collaborative relationship, and I think they're viewing it that way as well.
Well, and I need to say my goal, too, is to meet those triple aims and actually bend the cost curve and at the end of the day start seeing savings rather than additional budget allocations to support these. Once we get these models up and running and demonstrate that they work, hopefully, and that they are able to produce those savings, that we can start to see those on our books as well. So, I hope that we start to see that before too long. So, other questions of members? Thank you. Well, now we'll hear from a couple of the HCDSs and Hennepin Health. We'll start with Children's Hospital and Clinics. I have on my list Marie Christou, the General Counsel at Children's. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name once again for the record.
My name is Maria Christou, General Counsel and Vice President of Advocacy at Children's Hospitals and Clinics. Thank you for giving us some time to talk today about our experience in the HCDS demonstration. Before I start, I just wanted to take one moment to follow up on a conversation that you had earlier around the collaboration that has existed between the systems and the department. This has been a really challenging project. It's a new process for us, and as you might imagine, taking more risk and having the opportunity to see a lot of data we haven't seen before, it's all new, and it's a bit of a leap of faith, to be perfectly honest. And the collaborative approach that the department has taken all the way through the RFI and the RFP stage and giving us input along the way has been a really, really valuable experience. So I just wanted you to give credit to the department for that. So let me tell you a little bit about Children's experience in the demonstration. Children's chose to participate in the HCDS program because we were eager to apply what we have learned through our experience with innovative care models to this new outcomes-focused payment model. As a health system with 42% of our patient activity in Medicaid and paid by Medicaid, Children's is particularly interested in finding innovative ways to reduce the cost of care and improve health outcomes for our patients. As you know, Medicaid reimbursement is more than a decade behind in keeping up with the cost of delivering care. For Children's alone, that resulted in a $57 million gap between Medicaid costs and reimbursements for 2011. The HCDS demonstration allows us to partner with the state to explore alternative methods of providing and also paying for health care services. As care providers working every day with children and their families, we believe that Children's is uniquely qualified to develop innovative new models of care for our population. And in turn, the state is offering a total cost of care model that will appropriately reimburse us for delivering better outcomes. And that really is a new thing. That's a completely new model for us. As Assistant Commissioner Leitz noted, Children's expects to serve approximately 15,000 patients in our HCDS demonstration in the year 2013. Currently, those patients account for about 40,000 clinic visits, 3,000 inpatient admissions, and 2,500 emergency department visits every year. The children in our demonstration will include children we treat in our primary care clinics in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the surrounding suburbs, as well as children who we follow in our specialty clinics like our diabetes clinic or our asthma clinic. So the providers we have brought into the demonstration are primary care providers, but also some of our specialty providers who we believe, especially with children with chronic conditions, we believe that those providers can have be especially effective in managing the care of the patient population. We've worked with the Department of Human Services to identify specific quality measures that are relevant to our specific patient population. In 2003, for example, we will be measuring how we do with well-child visits. So are we getting the children in for the right schedule and the right number of well-child visits? We'll be looking at asthma care. Do we have asthma action plans? Do we have the right kind of care for our children who have multiple visits with asthma? How are we doing on immunizations? So are we getting the children the immunizations at the right time and according to the right schedule? And then patient satisfaction. We do a lot of surveys of our patients and our families, and so that's another measure that we will be measured on. And as Mr. Leitz informed you, any shared savings payments that come to Children's are contingent on us satisfactorily performing on each of those quality measures. So our payment is reduced if we don't perform as well. As you might imagine, providing higher quality care at a lower cost is no easy task. However, based on our experience at Children's, we know that progress can be made if the right elements are put in place to allow us to be successful. Since 2004, Children's has partnered with the state on a medical home program that provides coordinated care for children with special health care needs. So these are our sickest children who we see in our primary care clinics in Minneapolis and St. Paul. They have multiple conditions, and they are very costly, and they need a lot of care. Currently, approximately 500 children in our primary care clinics participate in this program. Under the medical home program, we provide care that's better coordinated and more comprehensive than routine primary care. This may include, for example, a longer appointment, complex medication management, bringing ancillary providers in at the time of the appointment so everybody can see the child at the same time. In that program, we receive a monthly payment from the state to help offset that additional cost. We have seen significant cost reductions in the early years of that program, including reduced clinic visits, inpatient admissions, and total inpatient days. At the same time, the satisfaction scores of our families have improved. As we now move forward with the HCDS demonstration, we hope to build on what we have learned in the medical home program and explore new ways to reduce utilization and provide high-quality care. Two key strategies that we're looking at Children's are expanded care management, similar to what we do in the medical home program now, but more of that, and new technologies. By using common electronic medical records and sharing that data among all the providers who treat our patients, we can provide more seamless care. This coordinated data also helps us better manage both individual patients and across patient populations and conditions. In pilot programs, we are testing different telehealth technologies right now that allow us to connect with patients at locations that are more convenient than the hospital or the clinic. Specifically, we have a technology right now that is a lot like Skype, if you've ever used that, where the care team can actually conference with a family and a patient in their home, and you can see the patient, and it's the closest thing to being in a clinic visit, but much less expensive and much more convenient. This simple connection allows clinicians to better assess the child and assist the family in providing cares. For example, if the parent is at home and has to do a dressing change after a surgical procedure, the clinician can watch through the Skype and actually see how you're doing that dressing change, and if you're not doing it quite right, can actually help you understand how to do it. It's really, really comforting for the parents to have that opportunity to connect with the provider that way. Even more innovative technologies that provide diagnostic tools, such as a digital stethoscope or blood pressure cuffs in the home, are in development. And with this kind of virtual clinic, the team can actually perform a clinical assessment of a patient virtually. While these advanced technologies are still emerging and reimbursement models will need to be developed to support their use, we believe that this type of solution will play a key role in improving care and substantially reducing costs for our future patients. In summary, Children's is pleased to be a part of this innovative HCDS demonstration. We believe that the experience will provide us valuable information, and it'll help both us and the state to improve care and reduce costs for Minnesota care, for Minnesota Healthcare Program patients. Thank you for your time and your interest in our experience, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Krister, thank you for the presentation, and thank you for going through the iterative process with the department and making that leap of faith. We understand that it is just that, and it's but we're really looking forward to seeing how this works for folks. Questions of committee members?
All right. Thank you very much.
Next, we're going to hear from the FQHCs, with the Urban Health Network. Jonathan Watson, Pat Rock, and Peggy Metzger is what I have. And I notice you have the acronym FUN. And I couldn't help. I don't know which is better. Assistant Commissioner Lights introduced the Minnesota Accountable Health model, which, when I broke that down, that's MAHM, MOM. I don't know. So FUN or MOM, I don't know which one is going to gain more traction in the public, but we'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. Members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. And again, I'm here to talk about the Federally Qualified Health Center Urban Healthcare Network, appropriately named FUN. And I just have a presentation I'm going to go through very briefly with you today and then turn it over to Ms. Peggy Metzger and Dr. Pat Rock to give you a little more perspective from the patient's perspective on what this innovative project is going to mean for their patients. So what is FUN? And this isn't an existential exercise, but but nonetheless, what it is a collaborative partnership of 10 FQHCs in the Twin Cities area that deliver care at 40 different sites. These are all still remain independent FQHCs that are community governed. The board of directors of each one of these organizations must consist of a majority of patients. They do remain independent, but they are collaborating underneath a separate nonprofit entity to further this goal of this project under the demonstration. They are, as we've established already through Assistant Commissioner Lights' presentation, one of the virtual models. I think it is the only virtual model. So what that means is we're not part of some integrated system with hospitals and clinics associated with it. So it is very unique, even amongst the six that are in the demonstration. So who are the FQHCs that are participating? I have their logos up here on a list, but again, I believe seven of them are from the Minneapolis side of the river and three of them from over on the St. Paul side of the river. And who do they serve? Just in general, I've shared this with you in the past, but FQHCs do serve all regardless of their ability to pay. 40% of our patients are uninsured. Another 40% are on public programs. Very, very poor patients, as you see, 95% below 200% of poverty are patients. And 70% come from communities of color. Geographically, we pool from beyond the city limits of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm always stunned that we cover 100% of the zip codes of Hennepin and Ramsey counties and go even beyond that in terms of the patients seeking care. As Assistant Commissioner Lights pointed out, this demonstration program is going to serve a subset of our Medicaid patients, specifically 22,000 high-risk Medicaid patients are part of this demonstration program. So why fund? Why now? The 10 FQHCs gathered about a year and a half ago and talked about this, and they really came up with three themes. One is to anticipate change. We're realizing which way healthcare reform, payment reform is going in this country, in this state, and we decided we can either shape the change or we can be shaped by the changes. We decided to be more proactive and control our own destiny in some sense. We also believe in expanding the FQHC model statewide. Elevating primary care and healthcare homes that focuses on the needs of patients and incorporating social determinants of health is critical. We also think it's a right time to do this with Medicaid expansion and more individuals covered through the Medicaid program. Primary care is going to be essential in order to keep the cost down of that expansion. And lastly, as we're mission-driven organizations, we're just doing right by our patients. We're stepping up because our fear was that any reform system would marginalize not only our patients, not only our organizations, but the communities that we're located in. So we're just doing the right thing for our patients at the right time. Our hypothesis in order to move forward on the fund project was just the historical underfunding of primary care and care coordination efforts that existed in the healthcare marketplace. Historically, there's been overspending, one would argue, in terms of hospital services, emergency room, and specialty care. So our hypothesis with those two pieces of information was targeted increases to primary care and coordination of care will really decrease total cost of care for a set number of patients. And once you look at our hypotheses, this is what community health centers have been doing for 45 years in the state of Minnesota. So it's very consistent with our mission. However, once we landed on this hypothesis, we looked at ourselves and said, well, we really have a need for data beyond the walls, beyond data that's available beyond the walls of our community health centers. And we also need a way to analyze this data. And so the fund group interviewed three or four different entities, and we ended up landing with a local company, Optum Insight, to help us with this task or the problem that we identified with the lack of data, knowing where our patients were using the healthcare system in general beyond our four walls. So at the base of the fund model, at the heart of it, is the triple aim. And community health centers are never satisfied. We had to add one. So it's the triple aim plus one. I imagine you're all familiar with the triple aim, improving clinical quality, improving consumer engagement, improve cost effectiveness. We added the one in terms of improving access to primary care. This is really one of the main drivers and solutions of the fund project to bring down total cost of care. The model, and I'll go over it very briefly, because this is the results, the fruit of about 14 months of work. But nonetheless, it's kind of a triangle, if you will, in a sense. And on top of that, our performance improvement specialists, they can be called kind of performance improvement coaches that advise FQHC staff based on the data you see generated down here in the lower left-hand corner from our partners with Optum Health, collecting a mass amount of data, analyzing it, figuring out which patients are of chronic conditions that need the care and need more robust care management. And on the right-hand side, you have their reinvigorated care coordination at the community health center level. So these three pieces are moving in conjunction and within themselves to really drive down that total cost of care. Just some more detail on that model. Again, the technology is really our partnership with Optum Insight to really track patients, look at the panel view, and assess system and clinic performance of the 10 FQHCs. The performance improvement specialists, they will be interfacing with FQHC staff for process improvement and also advise them in order so all of our 40 sites will gain healthcare home certification in the state. And then again, reinvigorating care coordination. This is really the key to make sure patients' care is coordinated amongst many different services that they're going to come into contact with in the healthcare system. Assistant Commissioner Lights really did a great overview of the virtual model in terms of gain sharing, but there will be a total cost of care benchmark established for the 10 FQHCs. The state will retain the first 2% of their savings, and then the remaining savings are split 50-50 between the state and the fund group after that 2%. I do want to point out that this just isn't financially driven. We also have to meet quality benchmarks and patient satisfaction benchmarks in order to gain some of these savings. So we may hit the financial benchmarks, but if we don't hit those quality and patient satisfaction measures, we're not eligible for any savings. So I identified probably three challenges before I turn it over to my colleagues here. The first, and legislators should be attuned with this one, but the first challenge being time and money. Remember, we are FQHCs, very razor-thin margins, not really able to assume a lot of risk, but nonetheless, in terms of just the amount of resources that were poured into this project from the community health center perspective, along with our partner, Optum Insight. There was also no guarantee of getting those savings. We put a tremendous amount of sunk costs, as economists refer to it. There's no guarantee we're going to recoup many of these sunk costs. There was no state funding to support these activities either. This was in completely initiative in partnership with Optum Insight, some of their in-kind services, and a lot of the in-kind services of the FQHCs. The second piece I do want to push back a little bit on is the challenge with data. We really do have a massive issue at the community health center level without interoperability in our state of Minnesota yet, and we've had this discussion a little bit here this morning already. But this really does puts us at a disadvantage not having timely information of where our patients are, what the discharge plan is if they're from a hospital. And I was very encouraged to hear that the SIM grant is, as Assistant Commissioner Lights pointed out, the SIM grant is going to devote some resources into this piece. So we expect that some of those resources will really benefit community health centers because we're one of the providers that struggle with this issue in terms of being able to collect the data and then analyze that data from our partners in the safety net marketplace. And then lastly, if we're going to be measured also on outcomes, and I've had this conversation with some of you in the room previously, but the way we measure outcomes in the state of Minnesota now for healthcare outcomes is not risk adjusted, and this could put us at a disadvantage. Our patient population looks a lot different than statewide averages, and when you're comparing us to those outcomes, it isn't necessarily an apples to apples comparison. I believe there were some resources that were proposed in the SIM grant to really do some more robust risk adjustment in this state. I'm not sure what the status of that is, given the announcement of securing that grant, but nonetheless, this is just a piece we do want to see some more work on in terms of making sure we're doing an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of measuring outcomes. So at this point, I want to be respectful of time. I would like to turn it over to Dr. Pat Rock. He's with the Indian Health Board of Minneapolis, and he and Peggy Metzer are going to give you a perspective in terms of the patient perspective of the fund project.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, is Dr. Patrick Rock. I'm the CEO as well as the medical director for the Indian Health Board of Minneapolis. I just wanted to take a very few seconds before I turn it over to Ms. Metzer here next to me, just to thank you. And we are at the Indian Health Board are very excited for this opportunity to participate in the healthcare delivery demonstration project. For some of you that may not know, the Indian Health Board here in Minneapolis is the very first urban Indian funded organization in the United States. And so there's currently 34 urban programs across the United States and many of the metro areas across the large cities. And interestingly enough, we will be the very first urban Indian health organization in Indian country to participate in an accountable care organization. So there's a lot of very firsts that are happening as far as these demonstration projects as they move forward. So there's a great deal of learning that's involved in this. From a provider standpoint, I can say personally that it's a very exciting proposition to be able to feel that I have a much more integrative approach as far as ability to look at cost and quality and patient satisfaction as far as the provisions of care that we provide at the Indian Health Board and also the other FQHCs that are participating in this particular project. So we feel that we've provided a very unique platform to provide those services. We've done this over for 40-plus years now in providing really integrative provisions of care to have the maximal outcomes, best outcomes for our patients as that's a concern. So so without further ado, I just want to thank you, and we look forward to further our learning in this process and our continued partnership with the state and the department, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rock. Ms. Metzer?
Thank you, Chairman Allori and Senators, for allowing us to be here today. My name is Peggy Metzer. I'm the CEO of the People Center Health Services, formerly having done business as Cedar Riverside People Center. Some of you might know of us. We're on the corner of 425 20th Avenue South in Minneapolis. We've been there 43 years, but we became a federally qualified health center in June of 2013. So we're going into our 10th full year having been a federally qualified health center. And that's important, I think, because in 2003, we had roughly 6,000 total patient visits, and in 2012, we had a little over 34,000 patient visits. So we've had very fast growth in a relatively short period of time. My very business-savvy volunteer board of directors, 60% of whom are patients in our clinic, help me and demand that I watch the bottom line very carefully. And so it's really important to us being a participant in FUN in this demonstration project is it lays a foundation for us to make to create a better vision of what our future can be. For example, in 2007, we opened a behavioral health clinic upstairs of our primary care clinic. Last year, we had a 43% growth in the inpatient visits to our behavioral health clinic. And we think that has in large part to do with the fact that in May of 2011, or 2011, we became a patient center medical home, which really integrates behavioral health with primary care. And so we are able to say to our patients, our behavioral health services are right upstairs. If you need help with housing, if you need help with managing your anxiety, if you need help with managing your depression, our physicians have suggested that you go upstairs and see one of our providers. We please encourage you to do that. And so that is one of the reasons we're having so much growth there. Also, we're partnering with Hennepin Healthcare around some of those social determinants that impact the quality of care and the frequency of care, and that partnership is helping us too. We purchased a dental clinic in October of 2010 on Minnehaha in Lake because there was a dentist there who was retiring, had been serving a lot of Medicaid patients. We had been looking to provide dental care. We hadn't had success getting federal grants. We started saving our money till we could actually buy one. And so we bought that clinic. We saved those 17 jobs. And now we're able to integrate our oral health care with our primary care and our behavioral health care. We implemented Epic as our electronic health record with the help of Hennepin County Medical Center in November of 2009. And what's very, very exciting about this from a patient perspective, I want to give you a really good example, is that, and this just happened about 2 months ago, We have bidirectional interoperability with the local hospitals and some of the other clinics because most of them use Epic 2. And our medical director sees patients. He has a full panel of patients 4 days a week. He had seen a patient twice earlier in the week, and he was awakened in the middle of the night on a Saturday by a doctor from an emergency room who said to our medical director, I have a patient here. He's given me permission to access the record. We're looking into the record now. We see that he was with you 2 days a week this week. I want to discuss the care plan. And rather than admitting him into the hospital, can we make an appointment for him first thing Monday morning in your clinic? That happened, and the patient was very, very excited because they were talking to each other, and they were talking about him, and they were looking at his record, and he had a sense that everybody was involved. And because we're a patient-centered medical home, and we have a huddle every single morning about those high-risk patients, and everybody in the huddle is all those members of the care team, he had all these people now who are really helping him with his care. So we're really, really excited about FUN. Because now we're getting all kinds of data from the department that we didn't have before. I was looking at some of that data last night. I'm able to see, for example, the same medical director, one patient came 50 times last year. Now, that patient's emergency room visits costs were not as high as another patient who only came 10 times. So now we have the data where we can start drilling down and figuring out what's going on. And maybe if we can have that patient that costs a whole lot more in that emergency come to the primary care once we learn more, that will be great. We can really help reduce that cost. And FUN is really giving us the mechanism by which we can do that, and the department is working with us, and you are supporting them so we can do it better. And then finally, I want to say about the patient experience, our patient-centered medical home has an advisory board of patients that has been working with us for 4 years to help us go through all the cultural changes that we have had to do internally to make sure being a patient-centered medical home works. And those advisory board members who are patients, they formed a support group. And now when they are having depression issues or anxiety issues or concerned about their blood sugar, because all of these patients have complex, more than one chronic condition, they call each other up in the middle of the night. So now we're thinking about how do we engage the community? How do we engage our entire community of patients to help each other address some of these care needs? And so I just wanted to share that with you, too, because it was an idea that I thought was really interesting because they're coming to us and they're suggesting it, and they meet every single month to try to tell us what we can do better to make it better for them. So, again, thank you very much for allowing me to share our story. And I want you to know it's very successful.
Thank you, Ms. Metzer. Thanks for the tangible examples of how this can work. I had one question for Mr. Watson. In your challenge number three in the measuring outcomes, you talked about the lack of risk adjustment. And I know that Commissioner Leitz had said specifically that they were adjusting for risk in patient health status. I'm wondering, is that a work in process? Is that and I know that risk adjustment is not an exact science today. Do you have the risk adjustment methodologies that are going to be used worked into your contract today, or is it an iterative process that you're not settled on yet, or how are just exactly where are we with that? Because I did hear two different things.
Mr. Chair, to answer that question, the current existing risk adjustment is really, as I understand, is based just on insurance status. It doesn't look at other social determinants of health, which include poverty, race and ethnicity, housing, other indications, at least in the statewide quality reporting measurement system, the SQRM system, as it exists today. We have engaged with the department over the last year or so, along with Minnesota Community Measures, to make a more robust risk adjustment measurement tool. And I'd have to say the reception to that has been favorable. I think we do identify that it does take a tremendous amount of resources to come up with more robust risk adjustment methodologies. In talking to my colleagues throughout the nation as well, it does seem Minnesota is kind of on the cutting edge of this, so there really isn't any tool that I can point to that exists throughout the United States on this. So to answer your question, I'm very satisfied with how we're moving forward on the risk adjustment at this point. We just need it very, very soon.
Okay. That's helpful. Other questions from members? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Claussen.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what your perceptions might be on your the effects on your programs of the affordable health care and the exchange. If you have any thoughts on that, please.
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen. We serve about 70,000 currently uninsured residents of the state of Minnesota. With the Medicaid expansion, we expect that number to go down. I do not believe it's going to mirror the 50% reduction or in excess of 50% reduction of uninsured in the state. We won't see that much of a reduction for uninsured patients. With regards to the exchange, there are some decisions the state is going to make relative also to the basic health plan. 95% of our patients are below 200% of poverty. So the folks between 133 and 200 are either going to go through the exchange or potentially whatever we come up with in terms of a basic health plan. If we go the exchange route, we are concerned about the ability for the exchange, the qualified health plans, to contract with safety net providers, including FQHCs. There's existing law that HMOs here in the state must contract with essential community providers, and we'd like to see that extended under the health insurance exchange as well. Because what that would ensure is that patients that have called, you know, community health center their home for 45 years can continue that relationship as their providers of choice. We don't want to create some in or out of network situation for our patients.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll move on to Hennepin Health. I have Jennifer D. Kubelius, Area Director for Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health, it looks like. Welcome to the committee. And I know Hennepin Health has a year head start on the rest of these HCDS projects, so looking forward to your presentation as well. And I see our former colleague, I should recognize Senator Berglund here, who I know was here when we got Hennepin Health started and is instrumental in the ongoing work on it. And glad to see you here today.
Yes, thank you. Jennifer D. Kubelius with Hennepin County. And thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators, for having us here today. I'm going to fly through this pretty quickly because we've had tremendous learnings in year one, which is what's so exciting about what the department is doing, is the opportunities are huge and the learnings are significant to improve systems and reduce costs. Hennepin Health is a partnership between the department and Hennepin County with our internal partners. As I'm sure many of you are aware, we operate a health plan, Metropolitan Health Plan. We have Hennepin County Medical Center, HCMC, which has both inpatient and outpatient as well as specialty care services. We have our social service arm, Human Services and Public Health Department. And we have North Point Health and Wellness, which is our federally qualified health care center. We, in addition to that, have a defined network of providers, which encompasses over 85 different provider groups as well within the project. The population served is the MA expansion population. And I was going to say I would edit this slide to say adults without dependent children in
you
the
did.
Home, and we got it already. So it is the MA expansion. So it's the low-income population, so 75% or below federal poverty level. And we currently have 6,200 members enrolled. We started, as you mentioned earlier, a year ago. What we found and the premise behind Hennepin Health is that if you looked at this population before the former GAMC, you often would see in medical records that it said patient noncompliant, not taking medications, not following treatment recommendations. When we started talking to individuals, what we're finding is the difference in what we're talking to them about. So walking into a doctor's office and explaining to somebody why it's important to take their hypertensive medicine in any given day for this population isn't necessarily effective. These are individuals who are concerned about where they're going to sleep tonight. They're concerned about where food is going to come from. They have life stressors that are often beyond what medical care is addressing. And I would reference one provider who recently came forward and said he'd been treating an individual for over 3 years, and she was one that had noncompliant all over her record. She had multiple medical conditions, and he didn't know how to get through to her. We had a community health worker one day go in before this practitioner, before the physician, and she came out and she said, "Don't worry, doc, I got it. I've got this lined up, I've got this lined up." She went through her list of all these social service needs that she had identified that this individual was struggling with. And he walked into that room and came back and told us, he said, "It was like I was meeting with a different person." And he said, her first words were, what do you need me to do today, doc? That's the difference in what we're looking to do, is try to make sure that social services and healthcare are coming together to meet individual needs more effectively. The business case, when we looked at the GAMC population, the Medicaid expansion, what we saw is often in crisis services, the top 5% utilized 64% of the dollars. It was very crisis-driven care and very fragmented. And I would say that's not unique to other populations, but it absolutely is a cost driver for this population. So our sense was if we could improve those system integrations and provide more care coordination, we could move the line. Real quickly, this is just some characteristics of the population we're working with. Significant minority status. This chemical use and mental health, you'll see 40% or more have mental health or chemical use. The more intriguing numbers are 60% have one or more or both. So these are significant cost drivers for this population. Chronic pain management is high, unstable housing is high, and multiple diseases is high. So it's a high-need population, significantly high costs as a result, and systems need to come together to work better, to better meet those needs. What we set for goals for the Hennepin Health Project was to reduce crisis care by 10% and increase primary care or preventive services by at least 5%. And that's our balancing measure to make sure that we don't just restrict access to services, that we're really getting them in preventive care. We also put in here reducing churn. The Medicaid population we're seeing on the MA expansion, a 15% churn every single month. So 15% of the population are falling off of benefits. Because we have the social service side, we're looking at the reason codes for those of, are they falling off because they no longer meet income requirements? And that's not the case. Again, we're working with the lowest income population. They're falling off because the system mails out notices that they need to renew their benefits to a 32% with unstable housing. We're not locating these folks. They're not aware their benefits need to be renewed, and so they're churning on and off the system. Unfortunately, the result of that is we have many members that go to fill a prescription. Instead of coming to the clinic where they would learn, we're still going to see you and we'll help you get on your benefits, they're going to fill a prescription at an outside pharmacy, being charged an amount because they no longer have benefits, and they stop taking the medication. The cycle continues because now they're back in our emergency department. The financial model, we do have the payment mechanism coming through the health plan, so it's similar to what the other health plans are doing in that we are working with the top tier first. So in order to pay for increased social services, in order to pay for increased preventative care, we've got to move those acute care dollars down first in order to have funds available to do that. So we're working with the top tier of the population, that 5% driving 64%, and front-loading supports there first. And what we find is that as we get our arms around that population and can reduce their costs, we're freeing up funding to do more for folks that need additional services and are not yet hitting our crisis services, but we want to prevent them from going there in the first place. System opportunities. What we found is individuals being stuck in hospital beds. This is an example of why systems need to work together. Oftentimes you'll find somebody's medically cleared, but because of their condition, we have difficulty placing them, and they're stuck in a hospital bed. That's high cost, and that's often cost that's not sitting at the health plan level. It's often cost sitting at the hospital. It's uncompensated care. And so how do we partner social service resources around housing and supports with the hospital and make it everybody's priority to together to move folks out of care? We found with that nursing homes, there was an assumption that nursing homes didn't want to take our difficult populations, so those with traumatic brain injury, high behaviors. And what we found when we talked to the nursing facilities is they said, no, we will work with yours. And as a matter of fact, some of them want to specialize in that. The difference is that we needed to partner together so that when behaviors were escalating, they knew who to call. They had a team that was responsive. So it's systems working together a little bit differently than we have historically. To highlight a couple of the system investments we had in year one, and I know you have a more detailed handout, same-day dental care. I heard that mentioned. The dental care was in month one of the project. We identified that individuals were hitting the emergency department in high numbers because of dental pain. And if you think of the traditional model, you receive an ED charge. You get pain medications often for a highly chemically dependent population. You're referred to a dentist next day or same day or next week for a population where transportation is a problem, and we all wonder why in 3 to 4 days they're right back in our emergency department. Those kind of data points have been just amazing for us to be able to say, how do we change the system, and we're motivated to do so, to say, how do we do it differently? Within a couple of days, HCMC responded and created same-day access to dental care near their ED. North Point responded and reached out to North Memorial and said, we'll send a van over. If you've got somebody with dental pain, send them to us. We'll go pick them up and bring them over. Don't even see them in the emergency department. Huge cost reductions, but also huge outcomes. For the individuals we serve, they don't necessarily want to be in the emergency department. And this is where the stinky onion that I talk about with this project comes into play. So we thought, pat on the back, we solved something, we did some great work. And what we found is there was a percentage of folks that exited out the side door, needed to make a phone call, needed to do a parking meter, never went up to our dental clinic, likely our drug-seeking population. But just having that data intelligence in the system so that we could flag those individuals for those chemical health services is critical. So what we find is we solve one thing and we find lots of other stuff that still needs to be worked on. Highlight a couple of other things. We've created a data warehouse, the ability to see across systems. So we have the health plan information coming into a data warehouse that providers can access. And I would highlight pharmacy example in that, is that our providers that are seeing individuals often know what they've prescribed, but they're not able to see real-time data, which is available at the health plan level. They're not able to see real-time data that shows them who else might be prescribing to this member, and is this member even picking it up routinely or filling their prescriptions. Great opportunities. We have found a pocket of folks where there was over 11 different clinics and over 7 different pharmacies that were prescribing medication to an individual. The cost savings to educate that member of those risks and rein those in has been tremendous. Patient radar reports. Getting information into a data warehouse is wonderful, but nobody has time to go through all the details because we're seeing folks pretty quickly. Resources are pretty tight. So we've created some radar reports that bubble up information based on specialty, based on information that those individuals need to know. What a community health worker needs to know and what a physician needs to know are often very different. Health plan and the provider record I would highlight on this slide. One of the other things we've asked for is oftentimes you see health plans have their own case management system. Providers have their own case management systems. We have asked Metropolitan Health Plan to enter critical patient information not into a separate system, but into the Epic record itself, which has been amazing data intelligence for the providers. An example would be the health plan is often the one that gets the call that says somebody's in an outside system hospital. Providers don't know that information. Now when they take that call, instead of it going into a separate system, it's going into the patient's record, and that patient radar report pops that information up to whoever their care coordinator is and provides the ability for the system to respond very quickly. Outcomes in year one. Admissions were decreased by 29%, and you see our per 1,000 measures. As our population is constantly changing, we've had to do it by a per 1,000 to make sure we're capturing same numbers. Readmissions have decreased by 2%. The emergency department has decreased by 35%. I give a caveat to that to say one of the strategies we did in year one was put in an urgent care venue. So it's urgent care. What I like about how they staffed the model at HCMC is that they staffed it with primary care access points. So trying to get folks in the urgent care, it's that medical literacy to connect into primary care is their main emphasis, has been a good first learning. Primary care has increased by 23%. I caveat this one, and all these numbers, if you dig into them, have some details behind them. The 23% increase is for those members who have been consistently in the system. When I spoke earlier about 15% is churning off every month, those folks are often the ones dropping out. So we took them off the table and said, for the consistent membership, what is our primary care increase rate looking like? And patient satisfaction is being measured on Press Ganey with an 80% likelihood to recommend services and programming. In the first year, we were able to save dollars and move some of those cost lines, and we have looked at this provider system to say, what do we need to do to reinvest in further cost reductions? So these are some of our reinvestment strategies in year two. The Sobering Center is the one I would probably highlight. So we have identified in the emergency department in 1 month, over 800 chronic inebriates that are going just to one hospital, just at HCMC, 800 chronic inebriates that are going into the emergency department. That's high cost. There are models around the country where sobering centers are utilized at an 80% cost reduction and better care, I would emphasize. So we're right now doing a modeling of a sobering center concept where we're going to utilize some of those funds to get that up and operational in Hennepin County as a pilot program. part of that is adding motivational interviewing. So right now what happens is detox is full. Somebody goes into the emergency department. It's first come, first serve to who goes to detox. If they have beds full, they end up sobering up for approximately 8 hours in the emergency department, which is a huge resource drain on the ED. And if you talk to our ED nurses, they say if you can get that population out of here, we can do so much greater things and why we're what we're here to do. So creating a sobering center would allow us to have people sober up in a safe environment and attach motivational interviewing, so services they're not getting today. The motivational interviewing is tied at seeing who really is treatment ready, who is ready to enter into treatment services. And that treatment-ready population is who truly needs to go into detox. Right now, lots of people are going into detox, and they may release from detox and head straight out and start using again. So it's targeting our resources effectively, more sufficiently, and hopefully getting better outcomes for our members. We have additional resources going to behavioral health continuum. So one of the things we found on the behavioral health side is that we often operate in the extremes. So outpatient care sees somebody, they start to decompensate, they send them to inpatient care. Inpatient says that they don't really need to be here, they send them back to outpatient care. And what we've done is working on some education to identify there is this dial up and dial down capability, but because it often sits on the social service sides, not all health providers are aware of how to access that. So it's connecting those systems to say, let's look at dialing up supports, dialing down supports versus working the extremes. We also have a vocational services program that is looking at getting vocational services in front of folks, again, to support sobriety and to support health outcomes. Next steps for Hennepin Health, we are launching those reinvestment strategies as we speak. We are sharing learnings for replication and further collaborations. So we have gone to talk to the Minnesota Hospital Association to say, we're being transparent. Here's what we're learning. Here's what we're figuring out. Take what you like and use it. We are collaborating with community providers to share learnings. And we recently met with the health plans to say, here's what we're learning that's working and that's turning the line. And how can we develop those partnerships into a larger model? We also are looking at additional populations. So our hope for Hennepin Health is we have put on the ground about 50% of our grand plan for the Medicaid expansion population. But there are unique needs in other populations. So what we're working with right now in Hennepin County is 1% of the county business. We're getting strong outcomes, but again, it's 1%. And it's sometimes hard to keep people's attention around 1% of the business. We are looking to get those additional learnings, increase the membership in the project, but also looking at different populations. Because as we start working with families and children or the disabled, the needs are different, and it will also show us where are the gaps in the system. We know the gaps that exist for the Medicaid expansion population. We don't necessarily know what things are broken for other populations, and we are hoping to do that in the next year. In closing, I would note one challenge that we constantly are hitting up against is data sharing. So there are statutes that speak to data sharing around healthcare providers. There are statutes around welfare. There aren't statutes that speak to crossing welfare and healthcare across those lines. And that will be one of our ongoing challenges. So we often hit against, I've got somebody on this side of the house versus this side of the house, and they can't talk about critical information. So one of our hopes, and we've talked federally about it as well, is that we get some mechanisms that allow accountable care organizations to share across those type of arrangements. Another opportunity, and it's not talking about sharing detailed patient information, it's really talking about where are their shared cases. So it's hitting big data. It's hitting who's deep end in healthcare, who's deep end in social services. If we have an ability to cross-reference those databases, we now know who to seek out to get that individual patient consent to talk about the detail. But until we can even hit the demographics, it's a real challenge. The systems are running somewhat blind, and we've got duplication of efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. DeCambilis. Any questions of members? Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Ms. DeCambilis?
DeCambilis, yep.
And Mr. Chair, you mentioned 87% satisfaction or likely to recommend. I'm just curious, how do you determine satisfaction? How do you assess that? And especially in view of, you said that you had identified 800 inebriates, chronic inebriates, plus you've identified people who were coming in just to get some kind of pain medication because they're chemically dependent. And then you've decreased admissions by 29%. where and when do you assess this satisfaction, and how do you get people to respond to it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, thank you. Press Ganey is a national survey instrument, so it is a survey instrument. So it's as perfect as the people that you get to survey. So we do have that N number of how many of the population actually take the survey and when do they take it. It is happening currently out of both HCMC and North Point's systems, and it's a general survey that's given to all of their population. And what we're able to do is we're able to tease out across all populations which of those are Hennepin Health members specifically and use those scores to analyze the information. So the point of service, is it at the point that we have a chronic inebriate in the ED? No, it's not. It really is a system survey that's going out across all payers, and we're just teasing out which are Hennepin Health members. And what we're watching for is, as we have a defined network, as we put different initiatives in place, and we're somewhat turning over the apple cart, are we doing what the members want us to do, and are they seeing that it's a friendlier system, that access is greater, that they're getting their needs better met? And so we are monitoring that. Now, I will say that 87% satisfaction, we need to get some updated trends and make sure it's going up, it's not going down, and these are some preliminary numbers.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. DeCubellis, a few years back, MHP discontinued their private fee-for-service Medicare plans. I'm just wondering if Hennepin Health is doing any work with Medicare-eligible individuals at this point.
Ms. DeCubellis.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we are not. We are currently only providing these services to the Medicaid expansion population under the demonstration project arrangement that we have with the department. We are interested in looking at those other populations and those other opportunities.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Claussen.
A question about the sobering center. Do you see this as a full detox facility or simply a holding area until there is availability in a detox center like
DeCubellis?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the sobering center is not a duplication of detox. It's really seen as a precursor. There is a population who detox, we're spending dollars we probably shouldn't be spending because they're not at at a point in their lives where they're ready for treatment. And so we're spending several days detoxifying somebody who may likely just start drinking again or using again. So the sobering center is not going to replace detox. It's probably not even going to change the number of detox. What it's going to do is get when detox, it's going to make sure that the folks that go to detox are more appropriate and that we're spending our dollars wisely. So what we do in the sobering center is it is a sobering up model. Typical length of stay is around 8 hours, which is what's happening in the emergency department, but that's a much more costly venue. So it's making sure somebody is safe. It's providing some support services when they're sober enough to leave the facility, trying to engage them in case management, trying to engage them in our community resources that exist. And then there will be a subpopulation who are treatment ready and detox is appropriate for, and getting them into those beds at that point. So instead of folks going straight from the ED into detox, it would be coming in, ideally not even coming into ED, coming into the sobering center. There will be a population who needs ED services, there'll be a population who needs detox, and there's a population that we will provide some supports and information for and continue to reach out and try to engage them over time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. DeCubellis, you mentioned the back on the sobering center. Are these people, are they self-entering, or is law enforcement bringing them in? What's the nature of that type of person?
Ms. DeCubellis.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a good question. We have done research. We put some individuals in the ED for a week's time to monitor just that. And what we find is there's a significant percentage that are coming in by law enforcement. There is a population coming in by EMS, and there's a population walking in. And we have those breakdowns of numbers. I don't have them in the top of my head. So we are working with the police department. We have recently met with them and talked to them about this concept, and they are supportive. We will be meeting with the EMS facilities and talking with them, and we have met with the health plans as well to look at how do we fund it on a long-term basis. And everybody being motivated right now to get better outcomes for lower costs has made it a collaborative that 10 years ago when we tried it didn't fly. But we think we've got the synergy today to do it.
Thank you.
Other questions of members? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation and the excellent work at Hennepin Health. We really look forward to partnering with DHS and all of the HCDS and the new total cost of care models and really bringing phenomenal results for patients and for our systems across the state. Thank you very much. And with that, we stand adjourned.